Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Every year, an estimated 8 million tons of plastic is dumped into our oceans. Think about that for a minute. 8 million tons. The United Nations has warned that this is causing major damage to marine life. According to Clean Water Action, marine plastic pollution has impacted at least 267 species worldwide, including 86% of all sea turtle species, 44% of all seabird species, and 43% of all marine mammal species. Today's guest, Dr. Marcus Erickson, has traveled to the most remote areas of the planet to see this damage up close. And he writes about his experiences in his book, Junk Raft, An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. He says it's time for the plastics industry and the oil industry to take responsibility for this crisis. Marcus Erickson is an environmental scientist, educator, and co-founder of the Five Gyres Institute. That's an organization that empowers action against the global health crisis of plastic pollution. He's also co-founder of Leap Lab, and his new book is called Junk Raft. He joins us from the studios of NPR in Culver City. Hi, Marcus. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us. This is such an important issue, and it's finally getting so much media attention. I mean, we're seeing photos of plastic around the necks of marine mammals. We're seeing ocean that's full of all kinds of different plastics. Of course, most of it is really tiny. You can't see it with your eyes. But the thing I appreciated most, I have to say, about your book is that you say, you know what, it's not fair to keep saying you need to recycle and you need to stop littering, which, of course, those are necessary, but it's time to hold the plastics and the oil industries responsible for this.
Exactly. You know, those two things have been told to us for decades. If you're as old as I am, you remember in the early 1970s, the Crying Indian campaigns that Keep America Beautiful put forth, which was a Native American standing in the road, a plastic bag tumbles by, and he sheds a tear. And the idea was, actually, the tagline for that ad was, "People cause pollution." And that was an industry-funded ad to drive home the narrative, from their perspective, that it's the consumer's fault, that it's your city's fault for not managing trash and washing their hands of any responsibility from industry for the kinds of things made from plastics. And now we're seeing, you know, now almost four decades later, we're up to our ears in this single-use packaging, the bottles, the bags, the straws, the cup lids, all this stuff that's designed to be thrown away but made from a material designed to last forever. And that's causing these mountains of trash on our land and this smog of microplastics worldwide in our oceans.
We should say that the Indian in that ad was actually not Native American. That man was Italian American.
Exactly.
Right?
Iron Eyes Cody. He was an Italian American, yes.
This is such an important point because I did not know until I read your book, and I'm so glad you reveal this information. You write that the plastics industry have successfully inserted language into California textbooks, claiming recycling and anti-littering efforts are the primary solutions rather than regulating products and packaging design. Can you tell us more about this? This happened in 2000. How did they do this?
Well, I think they're able to sort of keep their sort of ear to the ground and understand where all the different policy initiatives are happening from, you know, textbooks being decided upon, the language that's in the state standards for education. We just didn't catch on to that. And they were able to insert, once again, that false narrative that it's recycling, that it's the municipalities and our responsibility of cities to manage waste. And again, not mentioning, well, there are some applications of plastics that don't make sense, like the single-use, throwaway, disposable culture. So they were able to champion that narrative, getting into textbooks and putting forward, like you said, recycling and waste management, and ignoring the responsibility for the kinds of products made.
Like so many issues surrounding the environment, the onus is now on the citizen. It's all about the action that we as, quote, consumers, we're all always called consumers, can take, which is very important, right? We should recycle. We shouldn't use as much. We should reuse. But it's rare for the conversation to really focus on industry these days.
It is. It is rare, and I think there's a... It, there has been a this dominant narrative that we've talked about a few times now already about, you know, waste management, recycling, but the new narrative that's happening, and this is a fantastic sort of mobilization globally of what we call the Break Free from Plastics movement, trying to shift that narrative away from blaming individuals to sharing responsibility and primarily putting the onus on brands to say, look, you don't want your brand, your soda or your chip company or whatever, your fast food company, your brands all across our beaches and floating out to sea with your name on the product. So I think you're seeing more and more organizations, in fact, hundreds of organizations have joined Break Free from Plastic, looking at identifying the brands, putting the onus back on corporations to take some responsibility, to take their fair share of responsibility for this issue of trash worldwide.
You also write that the oil industry and the plastics industry have looked at the tobacco playbook, and they're very brilliant, really, when it comes to wording. So rather than say plastic pollution, they're trying to get people to say marine debris, so that word plastic is out of the conversation.
Yes, marine debris is such a benign and safe term. But, you know, this issue is so politicized at this point that you can't remain objective. If you use marine debris, you're buying into the industry attempts to dominate the narrative with this kind of language. You know, you wouldn't call an oil spill, if the Exxon Valdez were to spill something of that magnitude again, or like the BP oil spill we had in the Gulf, you wouldn't call it, oh, there goes some petroleum debris, let's recycle it. That makes no sense. Plastic is primarily a petroleum-derived material, and it's ubiquitous across our oceans. It is like the largest oil spill on the planet. And we call it marine debris? I mean, call it what it is. It is plastic pollution. And to use those terms, I think the industry doesn't want that. They don't want to associate pollution with their product, of course. But it's a very subjective perspective that I think in the big picture is harming efforts to save people on the planet. You're seeing this use of these benign terms that's undermining the efforts of many NGOs worldwide to call it like it is and regulate these products and advance the innovations that find new alternatives. To use the language, I think we need to stick with plastic pollution. It's what it is.
Speaking of oil companies, last month, The Guardian had a piece about oil companies investing in plastic factories. The Guardian reports that corporations like ExxonMobil and Shell Chemical are planning to pour $180 billion. Actually, they've poured $180 billion since 2010 into new, quote, cracking facilities that will produce the raw material for everyday plastics, from packaging to bottles, trays, and cartons. And The Guardian reports that these new facilities will fuel a 40% rise in plastic production over the next decade. That is massive.
That's a scary prospect, yes. So you see an abundance of natural gas being used to produce ethylene and propylene. And industry has had this growth curve for the last 50 years of a 4% per year increase. From making almost no domestic plastic 50 years ago to making, they just broke 300 million metric tons in 1 year back in 2013. And there's the anticipation of, in the next 20 years, like you just said, increasing by 40%, getting to 600 million tons by 2030, by 1 to 1.2 billion tons of new plastic per year by 2050. And that is, you know, from a business perspective, it's a way to secure your market. Now, the way they secure the market is by, in a strange twist of logic, by actually keeping recycling non-competitive with this new plastic. I call this the Great Divide, where you've got industry that's pushing to make more plastic and make sure last year's plastic, the recyclable stuff, disappears, largely through waste energy incineration. Then you've got the rest of the world, this massive mobilization, this movement that's saying, no, we don't want this linear economy from making trash to then, or making plastic and then burning it. We want more of a circular economy where companies are making products. Think of the entire life cycle from manufacture to production, consumption, then recovery and reuse. That circular thinking, it's contradicts what industry has enjoyed for the last 50 years, and that is make it, sell it, wash your hands of it, and have taxpayers pay to burn it. So there's this great divide between industry and environmental NGOs over how to proceed. And that's where I see either industry is going to be successful in making much, much more plastic in the years to come, or we as a global movement are going to say, no, we must usher in the circular economy for the sake of our environment. I don't want to be swimming through trash. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see species lost globally. I don't want to see people living on landfills and kids walking through trash to get to school. There is a better way, and it's happening. The mass mobilization is happening.
Let's spend some time talking about what we're dealing with, because when the media coverage really exploded around the huge gyre between where we are right now, San Francisco and Hawaii, and a lot of people wondered, what does this look like? Is this just like a big landfill in the middle of the ocean? Well, of course it's not, because the plastic breaks down and the plastic turns into tiny, tiny bits. But it's hard for people who have not been in the water, or maybe haven't been to some of these places where there's lots of trash, to get a sense of what this looks like. And then when you hear things like this Guardian investigation in June revealing that 1 million plastic bottles are bought around the world every single minute, and they end up in landfill or the ocean again, 1 million bottles every minute. How do you wrap your head around that? So you have traveled, you've been lucky enough to sail to the most remote parts of the world to see all of this damage up close. Tell us about some of those experiences. What really stands out for you?
Well, I think what stands out is my first experience, and that was working with Captain Charles Moore almost 15 years ago, going to the North Pacific. And this is back when, like you mentioned, media first portrayed this as these islands of trash in the mid-Pacific. And I sailed with Captain Moore right through the middle of the North Pacific gyre, where this fictitious garbage island was supposed to exist. And it's not there. We did see an occasional fishing buoy, and we found like one, I think, massive ball of netting. And then we'd find bottle caps and a few broken forks and occasional fragments of plastic straws here and there. But there was no island. But we did find, every time we would drag our net across the surface, is a handful of this microplastic confetti, if you will, like a kaleidoscope of multicolored confetti. And the best analogy for this, having now done this, our organization now, the Five Gyres Institute, which we began about 10 years ago now, we've now been to each of the five subtropical gyres, these massive circulating current systems. In the middle is where the trash, well, the waves kind of slow down. There's not as much wind or waves, and the trash kind of accumulates, but it fragments into all these particles. So the best analogy is actually more like a smog. If you think of the smog over our biggest polluted cities, like in Los Angeles, where I am now, back in the 1970s, you'd look up and you'd see this fine particulate, billions of pieces spread over a large area that carried its own burden of toxicity. The same in the oceans. We have trillions of particles, small particles of plastic, as big as a grain of rice or smaller. And we have found them from the equator all the way up to the Arctic. We were last at 72 degrees north in the Arctic, finding these plumes of microplastics. So I think calling it a smog. But one interesting point, you mentioned these 100 million or a billion bottles per minute. We hear so many statistics of this consumption. On the ocean surface, when we produced our first global estimate, it's back in 2014, after collecting all the available data in the world, we looked at our ocean models, and we estimated there was 269,000 metric tons from 5.25 trillion particles. Mm. That represented less than 1% of 1 year's production of plastic. And the point that was really driven home for me, the ocean is not the last stop for trash. It's a temporary place where trash on the ocean surface migrates. It gets obliterated and fragmented by animals nibbling on it, the sun breaking it down into microplastics, then it goes global.
In addition to turtles, for example, sea otters, these are the creatures that we're able to see and take photos of. There's so many very sad pictures of otters and turtles being pretty much strangled by plastic. But what's wild and so sad to learn about is that even in the deepest places on Earth, marine creatures, these amazing creatures that we're just now learning about, have been found with plastic in their stomachs.
Yes, and you know, when the show first started just now, you mentioned one paper identifying 267 species. That's about over a decade old, that one paper. There was one recently done by the Center for Biological Diversity, and they estimated over 1,200 species. And these are documented, you know, research-published cases of marine life impacted by trash. And like you mentioned, it's from the ocean surface to the sea floor and all the waters in between. And it's birds, it's marine reptiles. In fact, all sea turtle species are impacted by trash. I have a very good friend of mine, Wallace Nichols, who studies plastics in turtles. He told me, he said, Marcus, you know, it's not just every turtle species, it's almost every turtle. Mm. Almost every necropsy shows evidence of ingestion. And it's nets around the necks of marine mammals, from whales to seals and sea lions. It's hundreds of fish species. And I have one interesting story. 2 years ago, I had a chance to go to Dubai, you know, Kuwait, Qatar, and Oman, studying plastics in the Arabian Gulf. And I get to Dubai, and I meet this amazing veterinarian, Uli Werner, and he says, "Want to see plastics? Come with me." And we drive into the desert, and we're on top of this beautiful sand dune, looking over this vast landscape of acacia trees and red sand. And I'm seeing piles of white, and these are, what I learn, are the skeletons of camels. The bones are bleached in the sun. We walk down to one, and Uli Werner, he pulls a rib out of the skeleton, hands it to me, then he picks one, he says, "Start digging." So we're digging on this camel, and as we get inside the basket of ribs, inside its chest cavity, we find this mass of plastic bags, wadded and calcified, all consolidated, as big as a medium-sized suitcase. Wow. In its gut. And he told me, he said he began seeing plastic inside camels and all of his hospital work he was doing in the vet hospital about 15 years ago. And he says it kills them by blockages in their gut, gives them a false sense of satiation. They feel they're full and they're not, so they dehydrate and they're malnourished. Or it creates a toxic environment and they get sick and die.
Wow.
So we're seeing it's an issue in the oceans and on land.
How are they dealing with that?
You know, what we're seeing happening, and here's where, again, this great divide between industry and this global movement, Break Free from Plastic, of environmental NGOs worldwide, they're kind of different perspective. Industry still wants to push that narrative. It's you, the consumer. You got to recycle more. Or it's your city. Taxpayer programs to fund these waste-to-energy incinerators or recycle programs. That's that perspective. And, of course, it's hands-off trying to stop the design of single-use throwaway plastics. Then the opposite narrative, the other solution matrix that we advocate, what's best for people and the planet and makes most economic sense, is to pursue this circular economy where we take a hard look at the kinds of things we're making from plastics. The single-use throwaway plastic culture, the bottles, the bags, the cups, the straws, all of those together need to go. That's first and foremost. And then building into all the other things we use plastic for, from textiles to electronics, in hospitals, in cars, and appliances, building a circular economy where we think of the end life of those products, rather than the end life being a landfill or incinerator, the end life being recovery and remanufacture those materials. So that's a narrative being pushed by environmental NGOs worldwide. Let's get smart about how we use plastics. And that's a direct opposition to, well, let's just not regulate anything and just burn and bury it. So we're seeing those opposing solutions matrices being discussed.
Marcus Erickson is an environmental scientist, educator, and co-founder of the Five Gyres Institute, an organization that empowers action against the global health crisis of plastic pollution. He has traveled to some of the most remote areas of the planet to see plastic pollution up close and all of the damage that it's doing, and he writes about his experiences in the book Junk Raft, An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. He says that it's time for the plastics industry and the oil industry to take responsibility for this crisis. And if you have any questions or comments for Marcus, we'd love to hear from you. Today it is our One Planet series, the day that we talk about all a wide range of issues that really affect the planet. And plastic is, it's so, so important, because if we continue down this path, there will be more plastic than fish in our oceans. And there is a massive movement called Break Free from Plastic. A number of organizations are working to get a handle on this issue, and again, to hold the industry, lots of different companies and industries, responsible for this plastic pollution crisis. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org, tweet us at yourcallradio, or leave a comment on our website. Let's talk a little bit about how all of this plastic ends up in the ocean. Can you just describe what this looks like? Because depending on where you've been, I mean, I've been snorkeling in Belize. I'll never forget this. I was actually putting plastic in my bathing suit. There was so much of it. And this was a small island. And it's because of what you said. Things move. And a lot of people don't understand how that works. It's easy to say, why aren't these people picking up their trash? Well, in many cases, they're trying. But then the next day, they go out to the beach and there's a, you name it, baby, there's toys, shoes, lighters, bottles on the beach again. So can you explain how that works?
Sure. You know, what I think has happened, you know, through globalization, we have seen a rising middle class worldwide. And everyone wants the same sort of the culture of convenience that we have enjoyed in the West, here in the U.S. and Europe, for so long, for decades. And the rest of the world now wants that, and they're getting it. And it comes packaged. It's packaged in plastic. And the quality of goods are often less. They're more abundant. But what's not exported is the system for recovery, the system of waste management. So what you're seeing is this inundation in much of the world, throughout Africa, Southeast Asia, South America, an abundance of stuff that now is small, it's cheap, it's affordable, but the waste management infrastructure isn't there. So if you look at where the pollution hotspots are, and there have been a few papers published recently trying to identify which are the rivers that are the most polluted. And I'm sorry to say that Southeast Asia dominates that list. On the top list of 20, China's number one, but the U.S. is number 20. So what we're seeing happening is a flood of materials to these countries. But what we also see at the same time, and this is happening right now, is a fight in those countries to decide what to do with it. Like, for example, in Indonesia or in other parts in the Philippines, for example, you have the Mother Earth Foundation, the Break Free from Plastics movement, are working with NGOs on the ground to say, okay, in our cities, which are just leaking trash to the oceans, how do we stop the flow? You have amazing organizations working to build these material recovery facilities that are getting really good at sorting out the recyclables, sorting out the compostables, the food waste, the food scraps, the yard cuttings, and then what's left over, taking a hard look and say, you know, do we need these disposable diapers? Do we need all this stuff? If it can't be recycled, can't be composted, how can we make it better? That's happening in Southeast Asia. At the same time, you have industry coming in saying, no, don't do that. Let's collect it and burn it. Waste energy. So again, that great divide, the front line of this battle right now is how do we stop cities around the world from leaking trash? And I can tell you that there are a lot of cities getting good at zero waste. These zero waste initiatives by diverting compostables, diverting recyclables, and taking a hard look at the residuals left over. That's I think where, you know, if you listen to what cities are talking about, when mayors get together and talk about, you know, how to deal with waste in their cities, they immediately go to these zero waste initiatives, getting better at diverting wastes.
Today we're speaking with Marcus Erickson, an environmental scientist, co-founder of the Five Gyres Institution, and author of Junkraft, An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. And today we are talking about how organizations, cities, states, countries around the world are tackling this issue. He says it's time for the plastics industry and the oil industry to take responsibility for plastic pollution. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we are going to open the lines and reflect on the stunning rise of the Me Too movement. Over the next 3 days, we'll be doing special shows about this movement. We're going to kick it off by talking about how it happened, what it reveals about power structures in our culture, and what's next. We're also going to focus specifically on the media, and then we're going to talk about janitors, restaurant workers, farm workers, and other low-wage workers. In fact, studies show that the lower the wage, the more sexual harassment workers face on the job. So I hope you can tune in for our Me Too 3 days of shows coming up. And if you have a show idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today we're joined by Marcus Erickson. He's an environmental scientist and co-founder of the Five Gyres Institute, an organization that empowers action against the global health crisis of plastic pollution. He's traveled to some of the most remote areas of the planet to see the damage of plastic pollution up close. He writes about his experience in the book Junkraft, An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. He also argues that it's time for the plastics industry and the oil industry to take responsibility for plastic pollution. We've got a number of emails for you, Marcus. Michael writes in, given the poor handling of recycled plastic, should I send my plastic waste to the landfill rather than recycling it so it doesn't wind up in the ocean? Can you talk about how plastic is recycled? Because here in San Francisco, the city has implemented a zero waste by 2020 policy. And we just in the last month or so, are able to put plastic in our recycling bins. But I've been wondering, all plastic, big plastic, tiny plastic? I've been wanting to do a show about that.
That's an interesting point, because you have to think of, you know, what kinds of products are made using plastics and in what way that might help or hinder recyclability. Some things are almost impossible to recycle. And a lot of this has to do with the economics of these products, like laminates. If you put paper, metals, and plastics together in a sheet form, you make it almost useless. And it's destined then for a landfill or some waste energy facility. So also, if you look at many small plastics, small electronics, it's very difficult to recycle things that require a lot of time and machinery to disassemble. But if you think of, you know, where materials go when you do recycle, many cities across the U.S. are reporting high diversion rates, but in many cases, that diversion isn't to a local recycling, but often to another country. Mm-hmm. And if you've heard of the green fence or the green wall in China, the green fence was implemented, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when China said, okay, U.S., you know, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and the West Coast cities, if you're going to send your plastic to China in empty shipping containers, you better make sure it's a much better quality. And they began to put restrictions on the kind of plastics sent. In fact, I think maybe 8 years ago, I had a chance to talk with Joe Garbarino in San Marino. In Marin County, there north of San Francisco. And he said, you know, he collects plastics, all plastics from some in the Bay Area, mostly in Marin County. And he said, I have this economic reality as a business. I get a ton of plastics. I bale it together, and I have a few choices. First, there's no one locally that's going to take my plastic from me and recycle it. That the market for recyclability is inundated with supply. So he has two choices, either send it to a landfill for, I think he said, $62 a ton, and that was maybe 8 years ago, or I put an empty shipping container heading to China for free, or much less than that. And that was his reality. Now, if you think of now, China is about to implement this green wall, where they're going to stop taking, you know, trash from West Coast cities. That means San Francisco, the high diversion rates that you report up there, they're going to become much, much lower when the plastic can't go overseas. And that's where I think the recycling infrastructure across the United States is in a bit of a crisis, where they're going to be inundated with all the plastics that you just mentioned, you know, the laminates, the small, the big plastics, everything plastic in one bin, when the reality is it's not really designed for recyclability. And when your waste management system receives all that plastic, they're going to have to deal with a flood of unrecyclable materials. And that's, I think we can get ahead of that by really pushing hard for ending the single-use throwaway culture, which are really difficult to recycle, and stress circular economies for products. If you're going to make something, have a plan for the end use. Make it truly recyclable. So when your city gets, you know, hundreds of millions of tons throughout the year, that it has a place to go, and not just to fill your local landfill.
As you write in your book, Junk Raft, the recycling rate for plastics in the United States was only 9.2% in 2013. This is according to the EPA, because there's no obligation to design for it. Can you talk more about this? 9.2, that is a very low number. I mean, when we think about all the plastic we use, I mean, I keep going back to Amazon. You know, they sent out a press release bragging about the fact that they shipped more than 5 billion packages via their Prime service last year. Okay, that's a lot of plastic.
With 5 billion little small balloons in those boxes to keep products inside. There is very little regulation on the way plastic is used. You know, if you think of plastic, it's a lubrication for globalization. It moves things around. It moves Amazon's products and keeps them unbreakable as they go from place to place. It moves textiles, keeps them wrapped and free from moisture or from dirt when they go across the country. So I think what's needed is for industry to take a hard look at where their products are ending up. What is the full life cycle? And for us as a growing movement, as a global movement, to hold them to the fire, that you have got to make your products fully recyclable. When you design them, design a recovery system. Design for dismantling. Design for value. I would love it to see textiles, for example, a shirt that I buy, where the clothing, the labels, all the stitching, it's all the exact same polymer. And the company making that product has a plan to take it back. Maybe that shirt becomes a coupon for the next shirt that I buy. If you can apply that kind of thinking to all products, you will see recycling work. And there are many examples of companies that are doing that. For example, Patagonia, I wear their materials in that they take back everything. They even have a van that travels the country repairing clothes for customers.
Yeah, what a concept. I love that they say that. If your zipper breaks, we will give you a new zipper. You don't have to buy a new jacket. I mean, the problem is stuff is so cheap now because of, well, the high cost of cheap, but stuff is so cheap, so people just keep buying things. Diane says, you're motivating me to get involved. She brings up the example of Amazon, but she also says we should approach Walmart. They're the two gorillas, and encourage them, force them to ban single-use packaging from their suppliers to make a big initial impact. And I just want to make sure that we answer everyone's question, because we're getting a few more emails about recycling plastic. And people want to know that even if they do put plastic in the blue bin, will it eventually still end up in the ocean?
If it's in the bin, the likelihood of getting out to sea is reduced. There, it's captured and contained in a system. Now, of course, plastic film, you know, bags can still blow out of containers, out of garbage cans, even out of landfills. So I think, just to harp on plastic bags for a second, that is what I call one of the escape artists. Plastic straws, plastic bags, foam polystyrene, cups and plates that break down into small styrofoam pieces, all the escape artists that by design are difficult to contain and need to be dealt with by just elimination from society. They just don't work in our society. But the rest of the plastics, you have to ask yourself, where do like little juice pouches, where you've got metals and plastics laminated together, those are destined for landfill. They are so difficult to then take, recover, to clean, then separate. Economically, it doesn't pencil out. So it doesn't happen. If you go to recycle centers, you look at what they're actually moving around the country. It's soda bottles. PET has a high recovery value. So does polypropylene, polyethylene. You'll see whole bins of laundry detergent bottles all compacted in giant bricks. You'll see milk jugs, for example, all compacted. And the rest of it, like when I had a chance to visit Marin County Recycling a few years ago, they were taking all the leftover stuff from Rubbermaid garbage can lids to broken handles and utensils and baling all that up for shipment over to overseas, to China primarily. That's going to change really soon. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, one of your callers or just emailed you about getting motivated, I mean, that's where it's at. Joining the movement. Here at Five Jars, we have a foam-free campaign. The Break Free from Plastic movement is growing. Over 1,000 organizations. It's exciting right now to be part of this movement. And we're organized, and we're using the same common voice, the same values, and the same alternate narrative that puts the onus back on corporations to make smarter stuff. And think about the people at the end of the line. Think about the environment at the end of the line. And make sure that what you create, what you produce, doesn't cause harm. Have a system of recovery in place. And that's where we as a movement and all your listeners can get involved and put pressure on our policymakers, on corporations, to take responsibility for that.
I was just on the Big Island and you reminded me, I took a piece of plastic out of a turtle's mouth. You just reminded me of that little creature. We have an email about what you can recycle in San Francisco, and I just want to get this information out there. San Francisco accepts any rigid, solid plastic that holds a shape and is hard to break or crumble with your hands. Buckets, yogurt, clamshell containers, plastic toys, as long as they have no metal parts, batteries, or wiring. Plastic bags and other film plastics like tortilla bags and plastic wrap can now go into the blue bin. You just have to make sure there's nothing in it and bundle it all and then put it in your blue recycling bin. And go to sfenvironment.org for more information. Today we are speaking with Marcus Erickson. He is the co-founder of the Five Gyres Institute and author of Junk Raft, An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. We've got a number of calls. Let's take a few in a row, and then we'll get comments from Marcus. Let's hear from Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, and thanks for taking this subject on. I'm really learning a lot from your guest. I just wanted to share briefly Berkeley's history. They were the first, I believe, to do curbside pickup of plastic. And right away they found out, I believe at that time there was like four general types of plastics, and only one of them was able to be processed and then reused, and the other three ended up, at first they were being used in those like yellow barrels on the freeways, crash barriers, and a few other uses, but they just quickly saturated that many lifetimes worth of backlog. And so the city of Berkeley was also the first to stop the curbside recycling and essentially just said we just should not make this stuff because we were just paying taxpayer money to have it baled and shipped into the landfill. And so that was the city's policy at that time, is that the stuff should not be made. So anyhow, I'll take any update on that. I'm just curious what has changed since that early beginnings of that. Thank you.
All right. Well, since that's a pointed question, do you have any updates on that, Marcus?
Well, that's a very interesting point that, you know, some municipalities are dealing with an abundance of plastic waste in their blue bin, in the recycle bin, and realizing, what do we do with it? Mm. And I can tell you the last 10 years has been bundling it and either deciding, does it go to a landfill as this big, giant, one-ton brick of bundled plastics, or does it go to China, where there are markets in there, they were receiving it, you know, wholeheartedly in empty shipping containers. That's going to change. So cities, you know, it's happening right now. Cities are taking a hard look and saying, okay, if we're going to really be zero waste cities, what is the end game for all this trash? Because our diversion can no longer be diverted overseas. We have to find these local regional markets for the trash. And if we can't, which it sounds like Berkeley, that was their realization, what do we do with the stuff? If you can't, then you've got to really push hard for the initiatives that get rid of the stuff in our society that can't be recycled, that can't be composted. Then the rest of it, take a hard look and say, do we need this? Does the cost-benefit analysis pencil out? And that's where I think cities are up at the challenge. They're up to this challenge right now to deal with this issue. What does zero waste really mean? It's no longer diverting overseas. It's dealing with it here, regionally, locally. And that's going to be difficult because, you know, as we mentioned earlier, markets for the demand is nowhere near the abundant supply of plastics being used in our society.
Well, thank you for calling, Mark. Let's go next to Suzette in Berkeley. Hi, Suzette. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Rose, this is your freaked-out friend, Suzette, again. I call you every time you do a program on something that really wigs me out. And this is it. I have tried to edit extraneous plastics out of my life, and I find it very hard to do, but I'm really working on it, and I'd like to ask your guest. One thing I want to tell you quickly, my cousin, when she gets something packaged in a big box with Styrofoam, she mails it back to the company who she bought it from. So she just, and she holds them accountable. But my concern is this. Everybody feels kind of good about their recycling, and I don't think that means anything. And this really topic really freaks me out. So here's a basic question besides just being freaked out. Something like dog food. Have you noticed all the bags are plastic now? It used to be they were paper. Mm-hmm. And I buy an expensive organic dog food for my dog. But it comes in these stinking plastic bags that I know that just ends up out there. My Q-tips that I bought a month ago, they come with plastic little sticks and in a plastic container. I'm becoming incredibly anal about this because I don't want any of this. So do I go, how do we respond to this? This is what I want to ask your guest. Do we go to the producer? I mean, I'd like to say right now, everybody that produces items in plastic, I'm not interested. And I could name people, name companies that I do business with all the time, but I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But I'm not interested in buying chicken in a plastic container, a cooked chicken. You know, just what can we do? How do we address this?
Well, you know, I think that whenever I speak to, you know, a consumer, a citizen, about what they can do personally, it always goes to getting active, joining local organizations to pressure their city council to push these ordinances that ban single-use products. I mean, that's first and foremost. But when you talk about your consumption, and you mentioned a few things. You mentioned Styrofoam packaging. You mentioned Q-tips, the little the earbuds, a little plastic stick, which, you know, was always paper when I was younger, and dog food bags and all these things, all this packaging of plastic. What can you do as a consumer? And I think when we talk about zero wasting our city, we can also focus on zero wasting our lives. Look at your grocery list. My wife and I, we look at our grocery list, and when we buy the product, we say to ourselves, you know, we're also buying the packaging. I'm buying the box as comes in. And when you look at it that way, if you had the economic means, the alternative exists elsewhere to buy things that don't have as much plastic packaging. And when I say economic means, I mean that it is expensive right now, I think, to be completely plastic-free. You can do it. You're either investing money or investing time to make it happen. But I think over time, as we begin to eliminate these single-use throwaway plastics from our lives, the alternatives that might be a little more pricey now will get a bigger bite of the market share and become more the norm, and the prices will come down. I have one great story to share, and that is here in Los Angeles. We at Five Gyres, we were talking in many schools around the city about zero waste and the plastics issue. We met one school, Thomas Starr King Middle School, inner city school in Los Angeles, that were eating on Styrofoam trays. And the students and their teacher decided, we don't want to do this anymore. We're sick of eating on Styrofoam, knowing that some styrene might leach off of new polystyrene products. The students said, no more. And what they did, they took all their polystyrene food trays from 1 week, they washed them off and strung them all together like a giant rectangular snake, like 30 feet long, this long polystyrene thing, and they hung it in the trees. Their principal said, go for it. And they were able to change the culture of the school to now use reusable baskets instead of single-use throwaway trays. They saved that school $12,000 in 1 year. It took them 2 years of doing this until we went back to the school, invited back, when the superintendent of LA Unified School District and I think three city council members were at that school to announce the entire school district was getting off of polystyrene food trays. And then 2 years later, six school districts across the United States, Chicago, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, New York, LA, and I forget the others, came together and said, we're going to consolidate our buying power and we're going to buy from one vendor who can make a compostable tray for the same price as polystyrene. We'll give that vendor our collective business. And again, it gave the alternative, that market share, and it worked. So I think, you know, in our cities, that can happen locally. That's what I just mentioned was a local example. Getting our cities to be zero waste, from your own home to your school, your business, your office, your neighborhood, start there and the example is going to spread.
Thank you for the call, Suzette. Marcus, we only have a couple minutes left. I want to go back to one thing that you revealed in your book about the oil and plastics industry inserting language into textbooks here in California, saying that it's all about recycling and anti-littering rather than regulating products. Is there anything else you can reveal to us about what goes on behind the scenes? Because you also write about the American Chemistry Council, which is comprised of Dow, DuPont, Monsanto, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Shell. It was formerly called the American Plastics Council, but you write that they changed their name when the public began associating the word plastic with pollution. You reveal that they host these marine debris conferences. They fund NGOs like Ocean Conservancy. They do, you know, work against plastic bag bans. They do work to change wording. What else can you tell us about what we might not know about how industry is working behind the scenes?
Well, I think any time that you do any of the solutions we've talked about, you know, local product bans, initiatives like that, you have to look and see who are the other stakeholders that are participating in that conversation. I can tell you every time I've been to a city council for a bag ban hearing, industry is almost always there. In fact, I remember when the junk raft, that was a raft we made and sailed across the ocean on plastic bottles. We got the raft back from Hawaii, and we displayed the raft on the steps of the Capitol in Sacramento, about maybe 100 feet from Schwarzenegger's office back in the day. And within a couple hours, we had, you know, people from the American Chemistry Council in suits walking around our raft, picking off any media that came to talk with us. And their constant narrative was, we need more recycling opportunities. Nothing about source reduction or banning single-use throwaways. So I think industry is going to... They're listening to the movement. They're there when we rise up in city council meetings. And they're looking for opportunities to push that narrative and thwart any regulation of products or any attempts at source reduction. And it's happening on a global scale as well. I had a chance recently to attend the East Asia Summit in Indonesia, where they were talking about, you know, that top 20 list of rivers polluting the planet, Indonesia being second to China. And it was eight countries, Southeast Asian countries, with their flag on the table. Then there was Australia, New Zealand, United States represented, and the American Chemistry Council. They're pushing the narrative of we need recycling, more waste management, and incineration, and nothing about source reduction and ending the single-use throwaway plastic culture. So I think what we need to pay attention to, anytime we do anything to address this issue, look at the stakeholders and see who is pushing that old narrative, and confront them and counter them. And I think that is the best solution.
Well, here we are today. About 40 cities around the world have banned plastic bags. And now I am seeing articles from EcoWatch, for example, called Can Plastic Ever Be Made Illegal? So people are now saying that this needs to be heavily regulated. What are your thoughts about where this conversation is now going with so much awareness? And we've all seen the photos of plastic in the oceans, plastic around the necks of marine life. I mean, we're just learning so much more now. There's a lot more science out there around this issue than ever before.
I think when we think of illegal plastics, I think it is, again, specifically, it's a single-use throwaway design concept. We've seen, like you mentioned, you know, 40 countries have banned plastic bags or in the process of doing so. We're also seeing polystyrene bans. You know, our organization, Five Fires, has a foam-free campaign. You're seeing straw campaigns. Mm-hmm. You're seeing a lot of these single product focus. I think what's next, and it's happening in Seattle and Santa Cruz, looking at the whole concept of single-use throwaways, collectively putting utensils and straws and bags and foam polystyrene all in cup lids, all under the same umbrella and saying this suite of products have to go. So I think the next policy initiative is to look at a suite of products. And one thing that I'm not sure we have time to talk about this is the idea of preemption. Industry strategy, and this is what we should really pay attention to, is industry's attempts to put bans on bans. It's called preemption. It's state-level policy that makes local grassroots policy initiatives illegal to ban bags in your city. Hmm. That is a threat to the rising grassroots movement.
Marcus Erickson is an environmental scientist, co-founder of the Five Gyres Institute, and author of Junk Raft, An Ocean Voyage and a Rising Tide of Activism to Fight Plastic Pollution. Marcus, thank you so much for your work, and we'd love to have you back.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You can find more about the Five Gyres Institute at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we are going to kick off 3 days of shows about the Me Too movement. From judges and politicians to public radio hosts and actors, the power of the movement has brought down a wide range of powerful men for harassment and abuse. We're going to kick it off by talking about how this happened, what this reveals about power structures in our culture, and what is next. That is tomorrow. Your Call is produced here at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on produced today's show. Lauren Schechter is our social media producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.